Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now, the perfection almost of precision. If you're still wearing a wristwatch, many of us aren't, chances are when you glance at your Seiko or Swatch for the time, you don't take a moment to marvel at how precise it is. You expect that precision. Indeed, as writer Simon Winchester tells us in the prologue to his new book, this phenomenon of precision, like oxygen or the English language, is something we take for granted, which means many of us have never considered how the concept of precision was born. Mr. Winchester has, and as he joins us to talk about it, I'd like to hear from you. If you work in a field that requires great precision, maybe it's in manufacturing, maybe it's in art, in science, or athletics, I'd like to know how you came to embrace that idea and ideal of precision. So again, I'm saying here, precision can appear and be manifest in a lot of different endeavors. In athletics, in art, in science, in manufacturing, if you work in one of those fields where precision is really essential, I'd like to know how you've embraced that idea and ideal of precision. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, and I tweeted out a question on this. Simon Winchester is the author of a number of books, including Krakatoa and the Men Who United the States. The new book is called The Perfectionist, and he's with us from Philly. And Simon Winchester, welcome back to the show. It's good to talk to you again.
Well, thank you so much.
You've written about engineers. I hope you don't mind my broadening of our exploration of precision. Do you concur with what I said, that you'll find it in a lot of human endeavor?
I totally do. I mean, there was the chap that actually encouraged me to write this book. It was a stranger who wrote to me from Florida. A man called Colin Povey, who was a glassblower, he said, I've read all your books and I like them. And have you ever thought about writing a book about the history of precision? And I hadn't, even though my father was a precision engineer. But one of the later emails, and we corresponded over the last 6 years, I met him for the first time yesterday
at a book signing of mine
in Washington, D.C., a lovely, lovely man. And one of the things he said was, what about the way they time athletes at the Olympic Games? It's only at the moment to 1/100th of a second. Shouldn't it perhaps be 2/1000th of a second? Because modern athletes often tie very closely, because they're so finely trained. We need to differentiate between the faster and the slower, perhaps more than 1/100th of a second, perhaps 1/1000th of a second. So yes, precision infects all sorts of human activity, not just wristwatches and steam engines and things like that.
I noted that that sentence from your prologue where you talk about how precision is often in the background. It's invisible. It's hidden. And I wondered if, you know, is that the very nature of precision? I mean, we've become so accustomed to it. It is supposed to be in the background. It is supposed to be in some ways unnoticed.
It is and it isn't. I mean, it's the argument in this book, it's a history, because precision has a beginning. We know the first truly precise device was invented on the 4th of May, 1776. And I'll tell you about that in a moment, if you like, uncannily very close to the birth of the United States, of course. And precision now continues to the point where the iPhone that I have switched off, I might say, here in the studio,
Good.
Has a chip in it. It's called an A11 chip made in Taiwan. It has 4.3 billion, not million, but billion transistors in it.
Wow.
So the precision of that is astonishing. And I think because we know that kind of thing, and we know that, for instance, there are more transistors in the world today than there are leaves on all the trees in all the world. Because we read things like that, suddenly precision has become perhaps rather less invisible than it used to be. So we used to take it for granted, but now it's reached such astonishing levels that I think it's somehow hitting us in the face and we're thinking, my gosh, where's this all going to go? And that's part of the underlying theme of this book. Where are we in danger of fetishizing precision? Are we becoming blind to craftsmanship and imprecise things? So my wife, who is Japanese and Japan figures largely in this book, was saying this should not be a paean to precision. It's a fascinating thing, but we shouldn't worship it.
She's a wise woman.
Well, I think she's a very wise woman indeed, which is one of the reasons I dedicated the book to her and to my father, who was an engineer. But we shouldn't take it for granted. We should know what it is, and we should know what the downside, the yin and yang, if you like, of precision truly is.
Call here from Fred in Minneapolis. Hi, Fred. Tell me your connection to precision. Hi.
I really appreciate the concept. I'm a PhD chemist, and I serve as medical director of the clinical laboratories at a hospital in Minneapolis called Hennepin County Medical Center.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you one example of precision. A test we measure for determining whether or not someone has heart disease, specifically a heart attack. It's a protein called troponin. So my laboratory measures an immunoassay, an assay that a blood is drawn from a patient presenting with chest pain. And the precision is so important that if we give an inaccurate result around a cutoff because of imprecision of the assay, it can lead a physician to treat the patient completely different, plus change the life of an individual who might get a false positive test.
Wow.
I totally have lived my life around in the laboratory medicine world of the importance of precision in measurements of analytical tests in medicine.
So, Fred, if there were no instrument, there were no machine to take you to that level of precision, you would never be able to diagnose this correctly. A lot of it would be luck, making guesses.
Well, you know, we've moved over the 35 years in practice from a qualitative to a semi-quantitative to a precise measurement. So it has improved patient care not only on the short term for diagnosis and management, but by treating someone the right way, long-term outcomes are affected. So it has a huge impact on a short and long-term basis. So,
Wow. Yes,
we don't want to say guesswork, but we work with personalized medicine today. We want to make sure we provide the physician with the right answer for the right treatment for the right person.
This is such a great example. I'm so glad you heard the show. So, Simon, what do you take from that?
Well, what I take from it is if I can give another example of hyper-precision and its the potential downside. I mean, this will take a couple of minutes to explain, but it's all to do with a near terrible aircraft accident now 8 years ago. A Qantas A380, big double-decker jet, was taking off from Singapore Airport with 450 people on it, bound for Sydney in Australia. It got to 7,000 feet, all the engines roaring in a massive power to take it up to cruising altitude. Suddenly a deafening explosion. The left hand number two engine, the inboard of the two left-hand engines, blew up and shrapnel sprayed everywhere through the wing, cutting the fuel lines, the hydraulics, doing terrible damage to the flying abilities of the aircraft. The five people in the cockpit were able, magnificently fought battle, to bring the aircraft safely back down to Singapore Airport. They couldn't stop the number one, the outboard engine, all the control cables had been broken, and so they had to spray millions of gallons of water into it to try and stop it, but as it's used to going through rainstorms, it survived all of that. And only by great luck was a fire, because the brakes had failed, the wheels were white hot and fuel was gushing out of the wing, and the passengers were still sitting in the plane. Well, mercifully, everything in the end. After three or four frightening hours, the passengers disembarked and everything was okay. So when they did an analysis, they found out that what had happened was a tiny, tiny pipe called an oil feed stub pipe, which had been machined by a Rolls-Royce engineer in Hucknall in Derbyshire in northern England, had mismachined it by 1/1000th of a millimetre. And because of that, the wall of this tube was ever so slightly thinner than it should have been. The plane had taken off from Los Angeles a day before, a short takeoff. That tube, because they monitor everything that goes on inside a jet engine, had been under intense stress, but it survived the stress when the plane landed in London. Took off from London, stressed again. It didn't survive. It survived the stress when it landed in Singapore 13 hours later. Then, on this third flight, took off from Singapore and the stress was too much for it. It fractured. Hot oil poured out onto the rotor, this big mass of titanium in the very centre of the engine, where the parts of the engine are operating at temperatures higher than their own melting point, which is another story, how they keep them cool. It made the rotor melt and it wobbled and all the fan blades inside broke off, and like shrapnel they sped through the engine and did immense damage and damaged the wing and so on and so forth. And what you take away from this story is that 1/1000th of a millimetre was a problem that nearly killed 459 people. And are we consequently relying on things that are simply too precise? Are we pushing the limits of mechanical precision? Electronic precision is another story entirely, and I'll maybe get to that later in this chat. But mechanical precision, we're reaching down into such tiny, tiny tolerances that one wonders whether it's really worth putting human lives at such considerable risk for such tiny a piece of, in this case, metal.
If you've just gotten in on the conversation, you hear Simon Winchester there talking about some of the ideas that power his new book, The Perfectionists, How Precision Engineers Created the Modern World. But we've broadened the discussion to talk about how precision turns up in athletic endeavors, in artistic endeavors, in manufacturing, in technology. And I'm asking you, if you work in a field that requires great precision, how do you embrace the idea and the ideals of that precision? 651-227-6000 on Twitter, at @CarrieMPR, to John, listening in the UK. Hi, John. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Carrie. Hello, Simon. I'm actually right now at an opera festival here in the UK, and I'm a singer. And in preparation for two specific roles in my career, the barber in The Barber of Seville and Count Almaviva in Le Nozze di Figaro, these two operas, the plays that they were derived from were written by a watchmaker, Justin Beaumarchais, who became a French playwright in the 18th century and also was instrumental in helping the Independence Army in America gain independence from Britain by shipping them supplies. And the point about precision that he was a watchmaker as a young man and actually had a patent that helped make watches less a piece of fashion and more a piece of actual timekeeping, that got him into the court. And then as a playwright, using language and the precision of language to actually attack the aristocracy and the monarchy and to bring to light many, many aspects of life in that time period during the Enlightenment. And so he sort of had this incredible career. And it's just and of course, in music, everything is, we have a conductor that keeps time and manages a whole stage of action. So I just wanted to make that point.
Well, but John, I have to ask you before you go. I mean, aren't some of the most interesting moments that happen in the opera when you've strayed away from precision?
Yeah, yes, indeed. But, it's a controlled chaos. And that's what I think draws so much of the audience and certainly those of us that are on stage. It's escape from time, but it is very much controlled chaos. And I think that there's, it's interesting. You have to be flexible because you can never know what'll go wrong, right? If a set piece changes or if your colleague misses an entrance, if the conductor is using different time than you're used to, say going faster or going slower, you just, you know, the human mind, the eyes, the ears, everything working in concert and being able to adjust in the moment. And it's all really, it all circles around this sort of concentration on time, the time signature, yeah. The feel. So it's really, it's quite a thing. And for any of the listeners that have never heard of Beaumarchais, the playwright, a fabulous history. And it starts with him as a young watchmaker getting into the court of Louis, and well worth the history.
What an excellent example, too. Simon, I had no idea when I opened the phones that we'd hear such fantastic, creative ways of thinking about precision. What do you take from John's story there?
I love the story, and it's marvelous that you were at an opera festival in England. Give it my best. I miss it. There's an extraordinary device in the Smithsonian in Washington called Le Grand Tonomètre, which is an enormous, as it were, orchestra made of tuning forks by a Frenchman in the 19th century. And he ground these tuning forks, every one, of course, mathematically very precise, because the crossover between time, mathematics, music, of course, having a pitch, having a frequency, all very measurable stuff. And these tuning forks are so perfectly made that he would, and he had perfect pitch himself, that he adjusted the pitch of them by shaving or using a file the shape of the tuning fork, and then he'd put it down and he'd leave it for half an hour such that the warmth of his hand would be dissipated and it was back to room temperature before he'd hit it again to see if it was the precise frequency that he needed. Le Grand Tonomètre is not on public view. Sadly, it's in a warehouse in Silver Spring because nobody wants to see it. But it's a wonderful example of mankind and a musician grappling with the need of mechanical precision to create a beautiful musical instrument.
You know, I was thinking what John was saying about the controlled chaos of the opera and the music. And I was reading this interview that the composer Philip Glass did a while back. And, you know, there's a chaotic feel to his music as well, but there's also extreme precision. And he was saying that in order to play this music, it takes, in order to play together, you have 6, 7, 8 people playing precisely together. It takes a lot of concentration. And the fierceness of that concentration and the precision itself can be off-putting. So he knows that's required to play the music that he composes. But he also doesn't want to make it so overwhelming that that's all you take away from the experience of the composition.
That sounds absolutely right to me. I was just thinking of a YouTube video I saw a couple of days ago of the English Ukulele Orchestra, which has the lead singer singing or at least playing a piece of Handel. And each of the, I think there are 8 or maybe 4 on each side, so he makes 9, none of them using their ukuleles, but singing modern popular music, all of which clearly derives musically and mathematically from the original Handel. So all of them are playing off that Handel melody, completely different songs, and then all singing them together. So it talks about controlled chaos, and yet it's unutterably beautiful. So precision infects all sorts of things in the musical world.
Our conversation continues with Simon Winchester about precision. And John says on Twitter, "I find achieving precision requirements in aerospace manufacturing can be a fun challenge demanding creative solutions. As an artist on the side, I love the creativity in precision manufacturing solutions." And then Keith says, "I build reproduction medieval armor and material goods. I must constantly disabuse myself of modern views of precision, symmetry, and perfection." And to Johnny in Minneapolis. Johnny, thanks so much for waiting. I really wanted to get to your question. What are you thinking about?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I've been thinking about so much with all the people who've been commenting. This is very stimulating for me. First, I should also say, I hope that
Johnny, forgive me. I have to say, the connection is so interrupted there that I really can't hear what you're saying. Maybe you can call us back. That'd be all right? 651-227-6000, and I'll grab a call from Linda in St. Paul in the meantime. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I actually teach philosophy, and you wouldn't maybe think that precision comes up in that context, maybe given preconceptions about what philosophy is about. But precision. I try to teach my students to precisely define concepts mm-hmm. so that we can better understand their implications and their role in our thinking. Precision, I think, is the flip side of the coin to clarity. And I think that if we're more precise about what we mean about certain concepts, for example, like the concept of a right, then we can maybe understand that even though we may apply it a little bit differently, that we have more kind of commonalities in our views than is otherwise recognized. I don't know.
So Linda, are you, when you say you try to get your students to do this, are you looking for a precision of language or a yeah, go ahead.
Well, I mean, the precision in defining and analyzing and understanding a concept, and it is associated with language just in the sense that they have to express their you know, that precision in what the concept means and what the implications of the concept are. Having a precise understanding of certain kinds of concepts will allow a facility in the use of those concepts, making connections between your understanding of this concept and how it might apply or arise in new areas.
Linda, I think this is going to resonate with Simon.
Simon, yeah? <does.
laughs> Okay.
I'm listening here in awe, and I wanted to jump in, but I didn't want to be
Please do. Go ahead.
Well, let me say one thing, first of all, which is the English language is a remarkably precise creation because there are no synonyms in English. That people may be somewhat startled.
What? I am too. I wanted to make sure I heard that. What do you mean there are no synonyms?
There are no synonyms. There are approximate synonyms, which is why we have a thesaurus.
Oh.
But
you had me on
every
that.
Word is fit for purpose.
Uh-huh.
And I can give you an example of that by the difference between two words that you may think are synonymous, and that's precision and accuracy. These are different.
We had a call about this. Yeah, what's the difference?
Well, the difference, let me explain it. I mean, I use it relatively interchangeably in the book because the book is an informal sort of a colloquial book, if you like. But the two things are very different. Accuracy is how close something is to what you intend it to be. And as an example, if you're firing an arrow at a target, or this is America, so let's say a gun at a target, your intention is to hit the center of the target. And if you do, then you are very accurate in your aim.
Mm-hmm.
If you, however, shoot at the target, but every single one of your bullets or your arrows hits, let's say, an inch away from the center, but they all hit exactly the same place, time after time after time after time, you have shot with great precision. What you hope for is that you can combine precision and accuracy. Then the same shot, time and time again, gets to the center. But precision is doing the same thing again and again and again. And this is translated into mechanics in the whole world of the creation of what are called interchangeable parts. Interchangeable parts, which began with the making of flintlock guns back in the 18th century, a flintlock has about 10 parts. It's got a lever, it's got a trigger, it's got a spring, it's got something called a frizzle plate. In the old days, if your trigger broke, you had to go back to the gun maker and get a completely new gun made. But if all of the parts of the flintlock are made interchangeably, so time and time and time again, they're made exactly the same,
mm-hmm.
then you simply get a new trigger, put it in place, it'll fit, and you can go on firing to your heart's content. So it's an important distinction to be made. Precision, doing the same thing repetitively, hitting what you want to hit, that's accuracy. The two words seem synonymous, but they're not.
So as someone who frequently searches online for the synonym for a specific word, I'm still wrestling with what you said about that there are no synonyms. Are you saying I might find the approximate synonym for a word, but it will have a different dimension?
It will have a different shading. It's
okay.
Like it's fractionally different. I mean, sometimes monstrously difficult. I remember I was teaching once at the University of Chicago, and I was a chap, and this is to illustrate the misuse of the thesaurus. He was talking about potting a geranium, and his fingers, when they came away from the flower pot, were covered with earth. But he didn't want to say, my fingers are earthy, so he looked it up in the thesaurus and came up with the word chthonic, C-H-T-H-O-N-I-C.
Uh-huh.
And he said, after potting a geranium, my fingers were chthonic. And I said, do not use the thesaurus. Just speak like a normal person. Because chthonic does mean of the earth, of the underworld. But it is not the same as earthy. I know we're somewhat getting away from
I'm going to be using that word much more frequently.
Please don't.
Please don't. From Twitter, a listener says, this is going to sound dumb, but I strive for precise rev match downshifting during my daily driving in a manual vehicle. Right. It happens very infrequently, but when it does, it's wonderful. Okay,
it's
Johnny
so
is
sweet. Sorry, can I just respond to that?
Because you can.
In England, in the car, I mean, my first car was an Austin 8, I think, built in the 1930s. This was in the 1960s. And you had to do something called double D clutching, which is you change from, let's say, third to second gear by hand, and you have to match the speed of the engine. You press the clutch, you let the engine's revs die away a little before you engage the lower gear. And if you get it wrong, you get a horrible grinding of gears. But if you get it right, as this Twitter user is suggesting, you double D clutch and you feel it entering the gears with enormous precision, and you think, ah, oh,
you don't just hear it, you feel it.
You feel it, exactly. Yeah. Mm. And of course, automatic cars take that joy away from you.
Yes. Johnny in Minneapolis is back. Hi, Johnny. Are you there?
I am.
All right. Good. Thanks for calling back.
Yeah. This is such a stimulating discussion for me. Every topic that's brought up, the idea pops in my head. As the conversation about the double clutching, I'm remembering the joy of driving a 59 Rambler and the three on the tree shifter, and what a joy that was. But some topics that come to mind that I just wanted to lay on the table as an amateur kind of geek is radio. I used to be an amateur radio operator, and I think about the precision that continues to grow with radio and the building of the precise oscillators that are helping to make radio what it is today for people who are listening, as well as all the, you know, iPhones and other instruments that we have. But also with play and Lego. The Lego bricks, and my seven-year-old is building these machines with these gears that are so beautifully complicated, and I think about how that's going to apply to his life as he gets older, and the precision engineering that goes into making those, mm-hmm. That's how they're able to work, is because the manufacturing that goes underneath, you know, behind those Legos are so accurate that they're able to work again and again over decades of time and be compatible consistently. And it just brings me a lot of joy to see how that affects people and how it applies to my life with things that don't even have to do with directly with engineering. But
Johnny, I mean, I have to say, I think your point about precision and play, Simon, how we're learning you know, the ideas about precision as very little kids who are playing, how we're learning how to fit stuff together, and point well taken.
Well, absolutely. And the Lego thing, whenever I hear the word Lego, I think of one ridiculous fact that I came across recently because of somewhere I went. There's an island between Australia and New Zealand called Norfolk Island. It's a little slip of sort of subtropical land, very beautiful. It's where the refugees from Pitcairn Island were taken in the middle of the 19th century. This little island, which is known essentially only to people that live in Australia and New Zealand, has the highest per capita consumption of Lego in the world.
What?
Because it's a place that attracts people of, I wouldn't say a great age, but sort of people who are grandparents, and they come from Queensland and northern New South Wales or from the North Island of New Zealand to go on holiday. And after being there, there's not much else to buy except there's a gigantic Lego store, and they are advertised, buy for your grandchildren a set of Lego. And so they stagger back onto the planes with duty-free Lego in such quantities that no other place in the world can match Norfolk Island for the abundance of Lego.
Who knew? I think you ask this excellent question that we haven't gotten to in your chapter about Seiko. You ask, are we a happier and more contented collective of souls for possessing precision and employing it in our everyday lives? You left the question open. I wonder if you've reached some conclusion about that.
Well, I sort of have, and Seiko and Japan generally seems to answer this question. I mean, we think of Japan, do we not, as a place for ultra precision. We think of Canon, we think of Nikon, we think of Kyocera, you think of all these companies that have produced beautiful cameras or whatever with great, great precision. But at the same time, they worship craftsmanship. They work in bamboo, they work in lacquerware, urushi ware, they work in wood, do these marvelous pieces of carpentry. And Seiko is a good example, because if you go to the Seiko factory, as I did in Morioka in northern Honshu, you go up to the second floor and there is the production line for the manufacture of quartz watches, because Seiko invented the quartz movement, a watch with essentially no moving parts, which relies on the oscillation of quartz crystals and produces a digital readout, accurate, precise, to hundredths of a second. But on the same floor, the second floor of this factory set in a sort of bamboo forest outside Morioka, you go, leaving the chattering production line, which produces about 25,000 watches a day, into a sort of cathedral-like quiet area of the same floor, where 40 people sitting at desks with tweezers and magnifying glasses and all sorts of little devices, pieces of instruments, are assembling by hand Seiko mechanical watches. The line is called the Grand Seiko. And they're quite expensive. They're all made by hand with mainsprings and hairsprings and jewels and little beautifully fashioned gear wheels. And they are not accurate at all. You know, I mean, my wristwatch, which isn't a Seiko, it's a Rolex, loses about 5 seconds a week. I have a range of clocks which I wind every Sunday morning religiously. There are 8 clocks, grandfather clock.
Really?
And they're all wrong. And you have to, the joy I get from moving some forward and some back. There's this wonderful line in Dorothy L. Sayers' book, Gaudy Night, walking through Oxford at midnight and listening to the college clocks chiming midnight in friendly disagreement. Well, I love the friendly disagreement of imprecision, and I'm not going to worship precision, even though I've written a book about it.
Beth says on Twitter, I work in the hospitality field and train bartenders to precisely pour spirits to make perfect cocktails. Slightly more of something can change the entire flavor profile. And to Stacia in Minneapolis. Okay, Stacia, how does precision show up in your life?
Well, here's my question. I've chosen two professions that I've succeeded at. I am a successful commercial mosaic artist, so very precise work. Mm-hmm. And I do freelance writing and editing, which is very precise in the language sense. What I don't understand is how can I choose two professions that require intense precision, and yet in other areas of my life, it's total chaos. For example, I will pay my teenagers to wrap holiday gifts because I cannot stand the precision involved in doing that. So I don't understand that disconnect, that huge disconnect in my life around this topic.
Simon,
I think it's a left
think?
Brain, right brain sort of thing. I mean, I, in some senses, I love precision, but if you look at my handwriting, I mean, it is like a drunken spider with inky feet walking across a piece of paper. Why can't I do beautiful calligraphy? I mean, it seems that if I'm interested in precision, I should be able to make wonderful swirling letters and everything would be amazingly beautiful. I remember one of my colleagues in Malaysia, when I was a foreign correspondent, was the president of the Malaysian Society of Italic Handwriting. And he kept this formidable array of fountain pens and I should say one thing also, the ballpoint pen, which I generally abhor because I love fountain pens, has, as you realize, a little ball at the end of it.
I've got one right here.
Right. Well, okay, look at it, because the ball is maybe a tenth of a millimeter in diameter.
Uh-huh.
perfectly machined, because you feel the smoothness as you write it on the paper, and yet it's tiny bit smaller than the little cone in which it sits, so that ink can flow over it and be transmitted from the tube onto the piece of paper. All of those balls were made effectively by a little company in Winsted, Connecticut, about 5 miles away from the farm on which I live in, on the other side of the border in Massachusetts. It was announced about 6 months ago that a firm in China, which, as you will understand, is the greatest consumer of ballpoint pens in the world, has now worked out how exactly to make these tiny, tiny, ultra-precise balls. And a result of that, the mood of the people in Winsted, Connecticut, has suddenly dropped 1,000 points because they think what kept us alive ever since Mr. Biro from Czechoslovakia invented the ballpoint pen in the 1940s, and we have made millions out of it. We've kept lots of people in employment. This is the dark side, in a way, of precision, because other people can take over your skill and your economy plunges or plummets as a result of it. So,
are you really saying that all the ballpoint, the little balls that go into ballpoint pens, are made in one company in one place?
Most of them are. Most of them are made in the United States, yes, yes.
Wow.
Not all by, I think it's called the Winsted Ball Bearing Company. There are a few companies, but the best for the, you know, the Mont Blancs, and I don't think Bic, I think Bics are actually made in France. But now the Chinese have discovered how to make it. And extraordinary that it took them such a long time to work out how to make tiny, tiny steel balls.
Call here from Tom in Minneapolis. Tom, I'm a little short on time, but I'm really glad you waited.
Sure. I love the idea of music as kind of the nexus of precision and subjective art together. I teach music, and for beginning students especially, we're so focused on getting things right, precise. You know, are the notes clearly accurate what the composer wrote? Are you clearly taking a steady tempo that can be verified with a ticking metronome? Is the last chord of the piece the strongest that directed its subsequent phrase softer than the phrase before? So all these objective things that we need to execute very precisely, to me, give rise to the most subjective, profound feelings about music. So it's that precision, I think, that really gives rise to that subjective feeling.
And so, Tom, I guess the challenge for you is communicating that right to to your students, that precision matters, but only so far.
Exactly, yes. And that's, you know, that's hard for young students to, you know, to work through, because it takes a number of years, really, to where you can play, you know, accurately enough that you can give rise to the very, you know, profound subjective feelings that can evoke in people.
Thanks for the call. Simon, so I guess that's the question, right? Can you master precision so completely that you are able to throw it away in some ways?
It's a very good way of putting it. But I think, and going back to Japan, what I didn't say earlier, but I think we ought to bear in mind, is that, yes, we love precision. We welcome the fact that we've got these iPhones, that all the abilities that we have, and the experiments, the new telescopes that are being built, the extraordinary thing up in Washington and down in Louisiana that detects gravitational waves. These require a precision of an order which is unimaginable compared to its beginnings in the 18th century. But Japan so still reveres imprecision, the imprecise, the craftsmanship, that people who are renowned for making things by hand with bamboo or with wood or with metal or with lacquerware and things like this are given a government-sponsored, as it were, award. They're known as living national treasures, and they get all sorts of tax breaks and benefits because the government wants to promote craft just as much as the government wants to promote precision. This happens, to my knowledge, only in Japan and in Korea, and all the better for it, I think, because imprecision, craftsmanship, human scale things in nature that doesn't, after all, have any straight lines, is to be revered just as much as the cutting edge of something that's really precise.
Simon Winchester's new book is called The Perfectionists. Thank you.
Well, thank you, too.
What a fun conversation. We mentioned Philip Glass a little earlier. This is Violin Concerto No. 2.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.